where that's not terribly surprising with our, our next.
Good morning, everyone. The meeting will come to order. We will first welcome Sydney Jordan, who is a new member of the committee. Thanks for joining with us.
Excited to be
this
here.
This is a good day to come because it's going to be science and data, which always is good for getting us started for a new session. So welcome, everybody. You have the agenda before you. I want to get right into it because we have six experts in the state who are going to be talking to us about the impacts of climate change on our waters, something we have not discussed before in committee. And so I am looking forward to doing a lot of learning and taking notes. So with that, I would welcome Dr. Mark Seeley, who is going to be our first testifier. And if members remember, Dr. Seeley started us off last session, was our first speaker, and I know I took notes, and I have talked about what he said at practically every meeting I have been in, because I talk about climate change all the time. So welcome. We are so glad to have you.
Thank you very much, and good morning to all of you. Thank you for the opportunity to present some of this evidence to serve as background for your further discussions. I'll try to abide as closely to my time as I can. I will present as a caretaker of the state climate database for over 40 years. I will present some data and knowledge that we are virtually certain of. So as we go through this, I would like you to bear that in mind. And I will concentrate on the climate attribute, although there's many I could speak to. I will concentrate on the climate attribute that we know as precipitation. We, in terms of our neighbors and surrounding geography, occupy a piece of the American landscape that is seeing some of the most steeply upward trends in annual precipitation, and we have been now for quite a number of years. As you can see from the color-coded analysis by the NOAA scientists of the trends in precipitation over the last century or so, right through the Western Great Lakes region, the Midwest has been steeply upward. We have many areas in our observing network in the state of Minnesota that have seen a 25 to 35% increase in their average annual precipitation over recent decades. That geographically translates to this kind of a map, which shows mainly I'd like your attention to be drawn to the light and dark blue regions of the map. So that back when the National Weather Service was established in this state in 1891, the first three-decade-long normals period or averaging period that was used, 1891 to 1920, showed a rather restricted area of geography that averaged 29 inches of precipitation or greater on an annual basis. As you'll see in the sequence here, that area geographically contracted to just southeastern Minnesota during the portion of the 20th century that encompassed the Dust Bowl era of the 1930s. Then it began to expand in the later part of the 20th century, and now if you look at the lower right map depicting the average annual precipitation, you'll see that 53% of the state landscape now, in terms of the calculation of the 1981 to 2010 normals, sees an average annual precipitation of 29 inches or greater. The graphical representation from all observations in the state used in a smoothing technique to graphically depict it for each year on a statewide basis is shown. The upward trend in terms of Minnesota's annual precipitation is shown on this map. You can see on the far right hand on this graph, you can see on the right hand side of this graph the prolific number of wet years that have occurred in our lifetime. Even when we have had negative deviations or years with below normal precipitation, they have not been near as dramatically below normal as years in our distant past. This last year is, I seem to have just lost this. Let's see, what happened, Mike? This last year, 2019, as you've probably read, was our wettest year in state history. Okay, I'll carry on. This last year, 2019, was our wettest year in state history, surpassing formerly the year 1977, which helped us recover from the 1976 drought. We had, for the first time on a statewide basis, we averaged over 35 inches of annual precipitation taken across all observations in the state. There were many local communities, some of you may be from these regions, in that they represent your constituents, where they set new all-time records, including some rather lengthy records, I might add, some that have climate records that go back from 80 to 140 years, reported their wettest year in 2019. For example, over 55 inches in Rochester. And we had many areas of the state that had never seen 40 inches or more of annual precipitation that exceeded 40 inches of annual precipitation this last year in 2019. I might also add that not only was the number total for the year amplified, but there was also in many of these climate stations a record number of days that delivered rainfall. We had a number of months. Now, most of us in the room think of a month as roughly 30 days. We had a number of months in 2019 that delivered 22 days with precipitation. That is a very high percentage of days with precipitation. That's more like what you see along some of the coastal reaches of our country's geography, not so much the dead center of the Midwest where we reside. We also note that the associated data with that in terms of our state's hydrology show that many of our Minnesota watersheds ran at the 90th percent discharge volume for more days in 2019 than any days in history. So the volume of discharge out of this state because of this excess precipitation was a remarkable number. This still doesn't seem to want to advance, Mike. Sorry.
We do have, and the audience all has copies of these slides. So, here.
Oh, okay. Here it goes. You can see in 2019, all those states highlighted in the darkest color here all recorded their wettest years. All across the Great Lakes region and out into the Dakotas fall into that category. But you can see why widespread flooding was such a major headline in 2019, especially down through the midsection of the country, because most of those states were experiencing a year with top 10 all-time rainfall down through the center part of the state. And then on a more finer scale, where the National Weather Service can map these observations with 5-kilometer grid spacing, you can see all the areas of the country that indeed experienced the record precipitation, including these individual communities where we have long-term records in the state of Minnesota. I would like to conclude my remarks by noting that we have, since the establishment of the Smithsonian Observation Network in the 1850s on our Minnesota landscape, recorded data pretty consistently, very reliably, and the 1990s were the wettest decade in the 20th century. The recent water year from October 2018 to September 2019 was the wettest in all of that record period, by far the wettest in all of that record period. And we haven't yet tabulated this in great detail for the year 2019, but I'm sure our Minnesota State Climate Office will be coming out with those numbers soon. But we do know from preliminary calculations that the decade we are just concluding now, the decade of 2011 to 2020, will go down as the wettest decade in Minnesota state history. It will surpass the 1990s. Regardless of what happens the balance of 2020, it will surpass the 1990s as the wettest decade in history. I would like to finish with just a couple of remarks of my own. I served as your extension climatologist for over 40 years, helped look after the state database, wrote two books that were comprehensive about the history of weather and climate in this state. And I find now that as I still do education meetings around the state, most of our Minnesota citizens, far and wide, I was in western Minnesota just 2 weeks ago in Hancock, Minnesota, most are acknowledging this without reservation, that we are going through some very dramatic climate change. There is little denial of that anymore across our state, because our individual citizens and constituent groups are seeing right in their lifetime the impacts of this. And so this is having a very, very wide impact, and in my view, must be coped with, and we must accelerate our ability to cope with this, because the pace of change has quickened. And we are seeing these numbers change in very short order. Changes in precipitation over a 10-year period that used to occur in the paleo or geologic record over thousands of years are occurring at a very quickened pace. And that demands that we somehow find ways to adapt and mitigate this. So those are my opening remarks, and I'm sure they'll be amplified, Madam Chairman, by the other speakers this morning.
Thank you. Members, I think we are going to hear from our other speakers, and then we have going to have about a half an hour for questions from members, so you'll hear from everyone before we have questions. Next, we'll have Nancy Schultz. Thank you so much, Dr. It's always a lot of food for thought there. Nancy Schultz, Water Project Coordinator from the Fond du Lac Band. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for making the trip. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. Let me get my slides up here. Again, thank you so much for the invitation to come and speak briefly about some of the impacts that the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are already experiencing, and to some extent what we are trying to do about those impacts to water resources. First of all, if you're not familiar with the location of the Fond du Lac Reservation, we're in northeastern Minnesota, just inland from Lake Superior, near the town of Cloquet. And our reservation lands encompass about 101,000 acres. About half of that are wetlands and open water features, lakes, streams. So water resources are incredibly important and significant, and impacts to those water resources are also incredibly significant. And I'm going to talk somewhat about reservation, on-reservation impacts, but also somewhat about ceded territory impacts as well, because the Fond du Lac Band, as do other bands in this part of the country, rely upon off-reservation resources to sustain their traditional lifeways. So being able to protect those important resources on the reservation, as well as in the territories ceded under treaties to the U.S. government, are equally as important. This area is an area of abundance, and it's important to be able to access all of those healthy resources and to maintain them for future generations, because you just can't pick up and move a reservation. So some of the climate change impacts that we've already observed, as Dr. Seeley pointed out, in addition to that excess precipitation and the extremity of these events and the timing of these events, over the long term, and I speak from my experience as a trained aquatic ecologist, we're seeing loss of biodiversity, we're seeing erosion and siltation in our waterways, and I think you'll hear from some of the other speakers about that. Loss of headwater streams in this region, wetlands, especially peatlands and forested wetlands, which are a large part of the wetlands that make up our reservation lands. Groundwater drawdown, surface water quality pollution, and introduction and spread of invasive species. We're so close to the port of Duluth, where so many introductions of invasive species have originated, and some of that impact has been buffered because of our relatively harsh climate. As climate warms and winters become less severe, things like emerald ash borer and some of the aquatic invaders can gain a foothold more quickly. So what we're doing about that, our long-term water quality monitoring program has always incorporated the kinds of measures that will help us be able to quantify and detect these trends over time. It's not just water quality, it's things like temperature and thermal refugia in our brook trout streams where there's some cold water upwellings to mitigate against the warming. We've been measuring hydrology. All of our streams are gauged so that we can detect, you know, what the long-term trends are, as well as some of the more extreme events. We've been monitoring ice up and ice out dates because some of the longer-term records there have proven to be really compelling evidence about change that we're observing in our lifetime. You may recall back in June of 2012, we had a catastrophic flood event, about 10 to 12 inches of rain fell in a 24-hour period and simply overwhelmed all of the natural drainage in the region. On the reservation, we actually took advantage of that catastrophic flood event. Our stream gauge on Fond du Lac Creek actually captured that event, and we actually blew out an entire roadway and the undersized culvert that was impeding fish passage. And because we had the data and because we had the hydrologic information, we were able to go back and repair that with infrastructure that can better withstand the current kind of hydrology that we expect to experience. Some of the other work that we have done is in conjunction with other tribes in the region. Fond du Lac is a signatory to the Treaty of 1854, but we manage our off-reservation resources. The 1854 Treaty Authority manages off-reservation resources for the Grand Portage and Boyce Fort bands, and we all work very closely together. We're all working to manage and protect and in some cases restore resources, including water resources, in the Arrowhead region of Minnesota. And so about 5 years ago, we worked to do some climate modeling for the 1854 ceded territory. And then based upon what we were predicting and projecting for climate changes in this area, we did some vulnerability assessment of key resources that are important, whether they be wildlife, forest resources, traditional medicinal plants. I'm going to mainly focus my comments on wild rice and fish, and in particularly mercury in fish, because these are not only key resources and traditional sustenance resources for the Ojibwe people, but they're also some of the most vulnerable resources and least adaptable. First, the problem of mercury in fish. We know... I'm assuming that there's knowledge about the health impacts, the neurological impacts of eating fish that is high in mercury, and that there's been a lot of work done to reduce mercury emissions so that the sources are reduced and there's less mercury that is bioaccumulating in the food web. Unfortunately, up in our neck of the woods, our landscape is really efficient at converting mercury into methylmercury, which is the form that is then accumulated in fish and then transfers up the food web, whether it's wildlife eating fish or humans eating fish. And we're concerned about not only how that diminishes the ability to practice traditional life ways and eat fish in a way that is historically and culturally relevant, but we're also concerned that this problem is not only not getting better, but it's going to get worse, because the microbial processes that convert that mercury into methylmercury are accelerated under warmer conditions. So even a degree or two warmer temperatures will ramp up that methylation process. And it's not just the temperature and the microbial effect of mercury methylation, but just simply that additional runoff, as Dr. Seeley was talking about, the intensity of storm events, the timing of storm events, simply washes more mercury into the system. This figure demonstrates just mercury that's measured in young of year perch, so perch that are a year old and have only been living and accumulating mercury for a single year in a single water body. We were doing a study having to do with the hydropower dams on the St. Louis River system, and in 2012, that same year that I was speaking about with the catastrophic flood event, every single one of the reservoirs in that system showed a noticeable and significant spike in mercury in the fish from that year class. And it was simply because there was more mercury being flushed into the system. The other issue that I'm assuming you would expect me to talk about is monomin, or wild rice. Monomin is exceptionally sensitive to changes in hydrology. It requires a very narrow window of hydrologic condition, just the right amount of flow, the right amount of depth. And at the stage that you see represented in this photograph, the floating leaf stage, which is in mid to late spring, it's also particularly vulnerable to being uprooted if you have a really flashy storm event, because the roots are so shallow and the sediments in these systems are very unconsolidated. So it is under threat from pollution, from habitat degradation, and then it is also under threat from climate change, and both ends of the extremes actually affect the tribal communities. The flooding events can wipe out a whole year's production of wild rice in a given water body. Drought years, such as were experienced about 10 years ago over on the Bad River Reservation, didn't kill the rice, but it dropped the water levels so drastically that the tribe was not able to get canoes into the water and harvest. So those extremes on either end affect the ability to exercise treaty rights and to be able to eat the foods that have been provided by this landscape. So we have to continue to think about what we can do to mitigate for those impacts, whether it's aggressive restoration and reseeding, whether it's controls over hydrology in the case of wild rice, protection from some of the other threats and stressors. With regards to the mercury problem, this is just an example of how intractable this problem is for our waters. This is mercury data just in the St. Louis River over a period of about 6 years. And you can see that the mercury in the water column is exceeding our very restrictive water quality criterion for the protection of human health. And it's exceptionally exaggerated in years where there's particularly high flow, or if we capture a really high flow, like spring runoff event. So those are just some of the issues that I hope that you keep in mind as you're deliberating what the state can be doing to address climate change impacts, because it has so many effects on other resources. Thank you.
Thank you, and we look forward to asking questions, because I certainly brought up something that's troubling me. Joe Magner, a research professor at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. Madam Chair and the members of the committee here. My name is Joe Magner. I'm a research professor in the Department of Bioproducts and Biosystems Engineering. I'm a watershed hydrologist that I've been practicing this for over 40 years. Not quite as old as Dr. Seeley, but we've been looking at this for a while. And I'm going to kind of shift gears a little bit with you in the sense that I'm going to look at southern Minnesota and western Minnesota and primarily look in the rural areas in terms of how the land is being managed and with respect to the change in the amount of water that we're getting. So the title I've put out here is More Rain, More Runoff, More Recharge. Does that translate into a water quality impact? And the simple answer to that is yes, because we live in a state that was basically formed in large part by glaciers, and today we don't have glaciers on the landscape, but we do have a geology and a land use that has been fairly consistent over time. And from a watershed perspective, when we start changing any one of those factors, and particularly when we change the climate, which is changing now, there's a shift that's going to take place that can adversely affect then what's happening in our not only our surface waters but our subsurface waters. And so, again, as Dr. Seeley pointed out, we're coming through a fairly wet decade. This is some news that occurred back in 2016, where there was extensive flooding, and again, you'll hear more about that from an urban perspective, but in rural areas, this flooding has caused problems with respect to infrastructure. And in my experience of going through southern Minnesota, I don't see any more old culverts or old dams because they've been blown out. And at the county level, these folks have had to come along and they've had to put in new bridges and new culverts because what was there doesn't handle the capacity that moves through these systems any longer. But this also has affected our ability to measure flow. So this is a USGS gauge station that had basically been in operation for nearly a century that is no longer functional because of high water and the effects that took place on this concrete box that was really designed to last a long time, but it is no longer functional. But we need to have these systems in place because this allows us to look at loads. We'll say, so more hydrology, but then if we look at pollutants, in order for us to concentrate and calculate loads, and maybe you've heard about total maximum daily loads. This is a big part of what the state is focused on now in terms of understanding how we manage our pollutants. We need to be able to continue to capture flow. And in this situation here, the gauge station was destroyed. Obviously, it'll be replaced again. But understanding loads and this change in loads really gets then at how we look at pollution and water quality then within the state. Similar to Dr. Seeley, this is a slide that, again, just illustrates how significant 2019 was. Instead of looking at precipitation here, what we're looking at is cumulative flow on the Minnesota River at Montevideo. And you can see the blue line was the former cumulative record that existed, and the black line, which is from flow of 2019, shows that we've now set a new flow record at this gauge station in the Minnesota River at Montevideo. And again, we could put some other gauge stations up here as well, but the volume of water that we've gotten and what's moving now off the landscape is at an all-time high. Now, the problem with this is that because we have a container that basically has an underlying geology and a particular land use that's associated, if we start to change the amount of water we put through these channels, there's only one response that can take place. They have to enlarge. This particular slide was from 2007 down in southeastern Minnesota on Garvin Brook, where it came through Minnesota City and basically enlarged the channel quite quickly. But this is really the exception. The rule that's really we see out there now is that channels are enlarging slowly. There's bank erosion, there's bed erosion going on, there's scouring, and as a result, the amount of suspended sediment that gets picked up and then moved downstream then violates our water quality standards for turbidity and suspended sediment. Again, this all translates back into the fact that every watershed in the state has reached some level of dynamic equilibrium. And by changing the amount of water we're putting through the system now, it's going to translate into more erosion and more sediment that's going to then get into our streams. And the sediment then can adversely impact the habitat for the fish and other biota that are present in the stream. Shifting gears a little bit, if we look at agricultural management on the landscape, the farmers who have gone out and have put down their fertilizer have had certain expectations of how much rain would be coming, and when that's now changed and there's more rain coming through this, at different times of the year, it makes it more challenging to one even get in the field. But if they do get in the field and get their crops planted and their fertilizer placed, some of that fertilizer then can be moved off the surface or it can be pushed into the subsurface. Here's just an example again of that, that's almost a juxtaposition of what you'd expect, because this was a riparian zone that has historically been irrigated because it's sandy soils. But as a result of the amount of water that's coming down through the channel and then spreading out in the floodplain in the riparian zone, it's basically reclaiming floodplain that used to be valuable cropland in this situation. So, again, from my observation in 2019, there are many farmers who were suffering as a result of just too much water in the system, whether it was in the upland or in the riparian corridor. They had a more difficult time getting their crops in and out. And in the northwestern part of the state, more and more landowners are looking to subsurface drainage as a way of trying to cope with the amount of water that's coming. This is an example of a lift station where water is basically draining through the subsurface, then getting picked up and then moved into a surface channel. Now, the problem with this is that with any kind of groundwater type of or shallow groundwater system is that it's going to increase the amount of nitrogen that ends up in the surface water tenfold. If there's an overland path, there'll be less nitrate nitrogen, but in a subsurface path, we can increase the amount of nitrate nitrogen that then finds its way into the surface water, which then can have an adverse effect on macroinvertebrates, which, as again, as a state, under the Clean Water Legacy, we've been evaluating this for quite some time, and we understand that if we put more nitrate and more nitrogen into the surface water, it's going to adversely affect the biota. And that's a trend that's been occurring now for quite some time. And then a following speaker will spend more time here in groundwater, but for shallow groundwater discharge in areas of southern Minnesota where we're keeping that water on the landscape, but running it through subsurface tile lines, that water is fairly clean. And now clean water going into what was initially a designed ditch that could handle the drainage area is basically eroding and expanding as a result of hungry water from the clean water that's coming in through the groundwater to the discharge system. And it's also, of course, carrying nitrate with it. So these are a couple of the examples related to sediment and nutrients that are affecting more of our rural areas in Minnesota. And I guess we're going to hold questions until later then.
Thank you so much. We will have questions shortly. Jeff Groberg. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Minnesota, our surface water is our groundwater, becomes our surface water, and becomes our groundwater, and is our drinking water. I'm Jeff Broberg. I'm a licensed professional geologist. I worked for almost 30 years as a consultant in the Rochester area. I recently formed the Minnesota Well Owners Organization to represent the interests of private well owners across the state of Minnesota. I want to talk to you today about the impact of climate change on groundwater as I've witnessed it in my own professional career and on my own farm in the Whitewater Valley. Groundwater supplies, drinking water supplies for 75% of Minnesotans. It's a hidden resource that's largely misunderstood. It takes a great effort to understand the impacts of that. And it occurs, groundwater changes occur at a lot of different scales. There's immediate impacts with groundwater levels that occur within hours or days of extreme events. There's intermediate impacts that occur over weeks, months, or years with groundwater recharge in sensitive areas. And there's long-term impacts that can occur over years or decades. And we have people investigating those things throughout Minnesota. I'm going to show you a different way of displaying some of the same things that have been talked about before. On the graph here, it shows cooler years and warmer years, drier years and wetter years. And the 10 warmest and wettest years on record all occurred since 1998. That's certainly within my experience as a consultant and a landowner in southeastern Minnesota, and it's of concern. Because of the impacts that occur, what I'm displaying here are some data from monitoring well networks that the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources maintains hundreds of monitor wells across the state. And on the left-hand side is a well, a 305-foot deep well near Altura, where I live, and it's just the record of the last 2 years. And you can see the seasonal response from 2017, a very wet year, 2018 in the middle, a fairly normal year, and 2019, a record rainfall year. And you can see that the increase in water tables, even down at 300 feet, is quite dramatic. That represents an amazing amount of water stored in the landscape that recently infiltrated. On the right-hand side, this is the long-term record of precipitation in the state of Minnesota. And what I wanted to show here is that as we look at designing and predicting and trying to mitigate for issues, if we're using a 30-year record, we're really not understanding the acceleration of pace of the changes in our precipitation. And when we have a series like we have since 2007 of extreme wet years, we end up having problems and recognizing a wide range of problems. And it happens with changes in groundwater depth and changes with groundwater pressure and groundwater quality and flow rates. And it affects our drinking water supplies, our septic systems, our basements. It affects radon intrusion in homes, and it affects our cropping systems. You can see the data from the Environmental Quality Board, and all of these issues are pointing to more extreme precipitation events over longer periods of time that's having a big impact. Something we've touched on today, and the tribes have recognized, these groundwater-dependent ecosystems are always also impacted. Lakes, rivers, streams, and wetlands, and that's a major issue for homeowners. Immediate impacts and fluctuations of water levels, and these are all things that I actually witnessed in my professional career. On the bottom left-hand side, I used to be called to homes that had had rising groundwater level, and it actually burst their basements. Houses don't float. The geologic or the hydrologic pressure from rising water below a basement slab can actually burst the slab, and that's not an uncommon experience in the Rochester area. And people who dug their basements and the groundwater level was 5 feet below the basement, and now it's risen, and it stays high, and it bursts the basement. And if you're a homeowner, those are uninsured impacts. Those are on the people that live there. Septic systems. I've seen septic systems pop out of the ground with high water levels. These aren't something you can pump the water away. In Minnesota, counties typically regulate septic installations and require a 3 or 4 foot separation from the bottom of your drain tile to the water level. And now we're seeing that at ever higher levels, requiring more mound systems and more systems that are failing because of high water levels, especially in areas, riparian areas, lake shores, along streams or in river valleys where these water levels occur. Or flooded wells, dramatic issues of flooded wells, and old wells that are uncased and uncapped can become a funnel for water, floodwaters going in them. And in the case here, the water level had actually risen and created an artesian effect where now groundwater is flowing out of the shallow well. And we see massive changes in where water is coming out of the landscape. There's an area near Rochester that I watch frequently where the spring flow changes elevation throughout the seasons and throughout the years. And right now it's 12 feet higher than it was a year ago. The water level is actually flooded in the landscape very much higher than it was before. I want to show you two examples of how this is affecting public health. 2007 record flood in the Rushford area. Areas south of I-90 had 17 half inches of rain in a day. Rushford was flooded, 1,700 people evacuated, and 50% of the homes and businesses were damaged. The wastewater treatment plant was flooded, and 2 of 3 municipal wells were flooded. The wells were contaminated with bacteria, and they couldn't be put back online. And one well was sealed. The others were disinfected and flushed 15 times. And they said something else must be going on. This isn't just the well being flooded. And they started a program to try to understand where all of the contamination was coming from. And the geologists that worked in the area, Jeff Green and others doing dye traces, knew that there were sinking streams nearby where the floodwaters would actually disappear into the ground. In my farm, I can hear a sucking sound in the ravines when the water level's high from the water escaping down into the fractured bedrock. The flash flood created an enormous problem for Rushford. And they started looking, and they said, after we worked on the problem of disinfecting the wells, they were failing. They weren't getting anywhere. They sent crews out, and in a town that has a municipal water supply, they found 300 private wells. One home had 4 private wells in the basement. They found old city well number 1 had been buried beneath the bank building. And they dug up the boardroom floor and found a 580-foot deep well that only had 100 feet of casing. And that shallow groundwater was flowing freely into the well, recharging multiple aquifers with the floodwater. They found an abandoned hand-dug well at the old railroad depot that was 14 feet across and was recharging the groundwater at the rate of 450 gallons a minute with contaminated water. These are public health concerns. These are things that communities will face more and more with these extreme events. And just because we have a well survey that we know all of the wells in Minnesota since 1972, we haven't touched the tip of the iceberg with all of those old wells that can become a risk to the groundwater. Another more recent example, this happened last year in September. We had a fish kill in a small reach of stream on Garvin Brook that was mentioned before. I think Joe showed the extreme damage from the 2007 flood. This year, the upper 1.5 miles reaches of that suffered a major fish kill. All of the fish were killed. It wasn't identified until days afterwards. The report that was just released said it was related to intense rainfall events, and we think manure application or other farm applications that never happened in our landscape before with these intense, repeated 3-inch rains is running off organic matter and ammonia and killing the fish. The remarkable thing was that the state had just completed a series of dye trace studies in the exact reach of stream where the fish kill had occurred. They did those studies in 2014 and 2016. They put dye in a sinking stream, and it came out days later in springs and people's wells. The surface water is the groundwater, is our drinking water. These are real effects that we're seeing in real time in Minnesota. The dye traces show that there's 50 wells in the city of Stockton down gradient of this, and yet we don't even have a process to alert those people of the potential risk. If they're still drinking that water, they're likely drinking the water that killed the fish. Our organization was asking the question after the DNR said, well, we're glad the water got diluted and the fish kill was limited. We had to ask the question, how much do we need to dilute that water before it's safe to drink? Fortunately, now the health department will be involved in these fish kill investigations in our watersheds so that we can alert private well owners of these types of risks. So what do we need to do? There's a lot of challenges. There's a lot of variability. There's extreme events. And I think Dr. Seeley has noted in the past that we've had times in Minnesota where we have record floods and droughts at the same time, in the same state, in the same year. Those extremes are causing problems, but we lack a lot of knowledge. As I was investigating and reading some academic reports of this issue of groundwater impacts and climate change, the United States is far behind. Europe and Africa have been studying these issues for years. There's very, very little written in the United States about these issues. While we think we're leaders in many of these things, we do have the data, but we're not paying attention that allows us to come to a point of mitigation. We don't have an understanding, a good understanding, of surface groundwater interactions. And it happens in real time, in real places. I can see it happen on my farm where the runoff from my neighboring farm soaks into the groundwater. We don't know the impact of episodic events, and we don't have predictive models to predict what groundwater recharge or what that means to well owners, and we lack the guidance for remedial actions. So what do we need to do? We have an excellent network of groundwater monitoring throughout the Minnesota. The DNR operates that, and they're constantly fearing budget cuts and the lack of resources to continue the monitoring of those wells and those records. We need to support the completion of the county well atlas. That's something that is a little more than half done across the state, and it's on a schedule to be completed in 20 years, but it tells us what the geology is and what the risks are and what the hydrology is and where the sensitive recharge areas are. We need to make Minnesota a leader in research and action to protect the public health impacts of our groundwater. We need to model and communicate the risk to private well owners and communities that suffer these, and we need to develop the regional tools for defining the impact on our groundwater. Our surface water is our groundwater, is our drinking water. Thank you.
Thank you for that sobering presentation. Paige Novak?
Hello. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present today. I'm going to talk about a little bit narrower topic, wastewater treatment and climate change. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Civil, Environmental, and Geoengineering. So I want to make 2 points in this brief presentation, and those are that wastewater treatment is impacted by climate change and that climate change is impacted by wastewater treatment. And I want to start by going into a little bit of detail on what happens in a wastewater treatment plant, just so that everyone kind of has a grounding in what we're talking about and why these two things might be true. In the state of Minnesota, we have what we call separated sanitary and storm sewers. And so all these dramatic precipitation events that we've been hearing about, increased precipitation, that goes into the storm sewer. And those storm sewers are then discharged into receiving bodies, rivers and lakes, surface water. What goes into the sanitary sewer is the pipes that come from homes, from businesses, and then also from some industries. And those all flow through pipes to the wastewater treatment plant where that water is treated. So what happens in a wastewater treatment plant, when that water comes into the plant, it goes through a couple of stages. And that first stage is called primary treatment. And in that first stage, what we do is we let the water sit quiescently and the solids settle out. And so we let that material settle out by the force of gravity. We collect that as waste solids. And then the water moves on to the secondary stage. And in that secondary stage, we have bacteria. And those bacteria eat the organic matter that's dissolved in that wastewater. And they also eat ammonia, which is a nutrient that can be very toxic. And we need to remove that before we discharge that water to the receiving body. For the when the organisms do this, when they eat this organic matter, they form CO2, carbon dioxide, and that's released into the atmosphere. In order to get all of this to happen, the bacteria act very much like we do. They eat and they breathe. And so in order to get them to eat what we want them to eat, we give them oxygen to breathe. And so we as engineers pump in that oxygen as air, and that ends up using a lot of energy. And in fact, if you look at the energy use in a wastewater treatment plant, about half of that energy is used to aerate that wastewater so that we can degrade these contaminants that are dissolved in the water. Just to give you some numbers around that, if we look at the metro area, the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services operates 9 wastewater treatment plants, and its energy bill for operating those wastewater treatment plants is about $1.25 million a month. And so that's the amount of money that's spent a month to operate those 9 wastewater treatment plants. About half of that is used to aerate the wastewater. And so that just gives you some context for what we're talking about in terms of the energy use. We then take that wastewater, we settle out those bacteria, discharge the clean water, and those bacteria now become waste solids that we can also treat. So how is wastewater treatment impacted by climate change? We talked about where this water flows and how we've got more precipitation and more flashy events. And so it seems like this wouldn't actually impact a wastewater treatment plant because that material is going out through the storm sewer. But if you look at the pipes that connect our homes and our businesses to that wastewater treatment plant, they don't always function the way that they should. And one of the primary impacts of climate change is increased inflow and infiltration. Inflow is the water that comes in from, say, a manhole cover that's not properly sealed. It comes directly into the sanitary sewer. Or if you have gutters that are improperly connected to the sanitary sewer, you get inflow that way. Infiltration is the water that comes into that sanitary sewer system through pipes that are corroding, cracking, there's root intrusion, the joints aren't properly sealed. All of that causes water to get into that sanitary sewer system. And what we see is that with increased precipitation and extreme events, there's increased inflow and infiltration. And what these increased flows can do is that they can exceed the sewer capacity, they can exceed lift station capacity and plant capacity. And what this can do is cause infrastructure damage, permit violations, and pollution to our receiving bodies. And this is a problem that has been on the radar for a long time. The Pollution Control Agency and communities in Minnesota have been addressing this for over a decade. But this is really one of the primary problems of impact or of climate change on wastewater treatment. So I want to kind of switch gears just a little bit and talk briefly about how climate change is impacted by wastewater treatment. I talked about this aeration that we do to the wastewater in order to treat it and how much money and how much energy this takes. And if you look nationwide, wastewater treatment accounts for about 2% of the total U.S. energy use, which I think is a staggering number. 2% maybe doesn't sound as dramatic as 50%, but this is for wastewater, which is something we don't really think about. And if you look at wastewater, we're actually taking an energy-rich material, and we're using energy to treat that and turn it into CO2 instead of capturing that energy. This also contributes a lot of CO2 equivalents per year to the atmosphere, about 35 teragrams of CO2, equivalents per year. In 2010, there was a study that linked the energy costs of wastewater treatment to an actual dollar amount, and that was $2.8 billion. And so we're spending a lot of money to treat wastewater to turn it into CO2.
Is that $2 billion nationwide?
Nationwide, yeah. Good clarification. So this has really driven this goal to create energy-neutral wastewater treatment plants. And this has been a goal of the wastewater community for at least a decade. And this can be done for with a number of different steps. First, we can look at efficiency improvements. You can look at use of renewable energy in plant operations. Energy recovery via waste solids processing. So I mentioned those waste solids that are generated. We can actually treat those in a way that can generate energy that we can use within the plant. You can recover the wastewater heat. There's a fair amount of heat embedded in that wastewater that can be recovered. Also, recover energy via treatment of other industrial and food waste streams. And finally, pursue low energy nutrient removal. I talked about how we have to use oxygen and aeration in order to treat ammonia. Well, there are other methods we can use to treat ammonia that are much less energy intensive. All of these things are being pursued at the plant level, and I'll give you an example of a wastewater treatment plant in Minnesota that's, I think, on the forefront of all of this. And we're also looking into this in terms of research, and I'll give you a couple of examples of that as well. This is an example of the St. Cloud Wastewater Treatment Plant. This was a slide that was given to me by Tracy Hodel, who's a public services director for the city of St. Cloud. I look at St. Cloud as really sort of the poster child example of energy efficiency at a wastewater treatment plant. They're doing all of those things that I mentioned. They've put in a lot of energy efficiency measures. They're recovering their waste solids and also taking in industrial high-strength waste in order to create energy. They've put in a solar array and are also making use of community-based solar. They're also doing things that aren't directly tied to climate change but are in the interest of sustainability in terms of looking at reusing the nutrients that they're capturing from that wastewater. This just shows a couple of photos. The top one is the Hutchinson Wastewater Treatment Plant, which also has a large solar array, and they're about 17 to 20% solar energy powered. So this isn't just something that large metro areas like St. Cloud can tackle. The bottom photo is of St. Cloud's solar array. And then to kind of circle back to my interest, I'm a professor, so I do research. The areas that a lot of people are doing research in now, including myself, are the areas of energy recovery via treatment of industrial and food waste streams, and then also low energy nutrient removal. And I'm not sure if that's, oh, it is working. This is some work that we're doing in our lab looking at high strength wastewater, the kind of wastewater you would have in a dairy or a malting plant, a brewery, and we're generating hydrogen gas that we're then running through a fuel cell to generate electricity. We also have a pilot scale project, a small pilot project where we're taking brewery wastewater at the Fulton Brewery using a novel two-stage system to generate methane and hydrogen from that wastewater and treat that wastewater. So now it doesn't need to be treated in an energy-intensive way at the municipal wastewater treatment plant. And finally, we're also doing research on low-energy nutrient treatment. We're looking at a system called ANAMOX, anaerobic ammonia oxidation, and this process uses about a third of the energy of traditional ammonia treatment. And in order to do this, we're working with colleagues in chemistry and chemical engineering to make novel materials that then we can put into reactors and use that to attract these special bacteria that grow incredibly slowly and are difficult to retain. And we can also use that to feed the air very precisely to those organisms to really make this process happen efficiently and successfully. And so with that, I thank you for your attention. I've got my email address on there. If anyone has questions that aren't addressed today, I'm happy to respond. Thank you.
Thank you. Randy Niepresch.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to speak. I'm going to speak about the impacts of climate change on municipal stormwater systems. My name's Randy Niepresch. Unlike all the other speakers this morning, I am a civil engineer. I work with Stantec Consulting under contract with as the staff of the Minnesota City's Stormwater Coalition. Our coalition is comprised of about 130 of the cities in Minnesota that are regulated under the MS4 Stormwater Permitting Program. MS4 in this case stands for Municipal Separate Storm Sewer Systems. Our coalition is directly affiliated with the League of Minnesota Cities, though it should be noted that I do not speak for the League. For that, you should rely on Craig Johnson, please. As you've heard from all the other speakers, we're simply getting more rain. But even more important and more dramatic for municipal stormwater systems, more of that rain is coming in intense storms. And this obviously produces significant challenges for our systems. A useful way to look at this is some of these challenges are simply on the water quantity side, otherwise known as localized flooding. But we also see accompanying water quality challenges as well. Simply in the urban landscape, when an intense storm shows up, lots of things start to move across the landscape. Things like dirt, but also phosphorus and bacteria. Our cities, over the last, say, 20 years or so, have been installing relatively new, small, decentralized water quality stormwater features, things like rain gardens, infiltration basins. These small features are overwhelmed very quickly by intense storms, and then almost all the storm has to bypass those systems and move on down to receiving waters. A little bit of background. We use essentially three design levels when we put these systems together. The catch basin piping systems, kind of the traditional municipal stormwater systems, are designed to handle approximately the 10-year storm. There's a limit as to what you can do with pipes and catch basins. But then our next step is we look at the 100-year storm it's the design basis to safely locate and set the elevations for buildings and infrastructure with an additional factor of safety. Call it 2 to 3 feet of freeboard. But then we also consider the maximum probable storm. These are the historic storms that we try to anticipate, and we work diligently to design and build systems so that the impacts in terms of property damage, perils for humans, are kept to a minimum, even for these historic storms. So how are cities addressing these new challenges because of the changes in rainfall? One way we look at it is it's simply one more thing that cities have to do. It's kind of the story of our lives at the municipal level. Cities have traditionally done an excellent job of dealing with floods, and now we simply have to deal with more of them and at a greater level. We do that with relatively little assistance from either the federal government nowadays or the state government. Another way to look at it, remember the quantity versus quality question. Over the last 20 years, under the MS4 Stormwater Permitting Program, cities have been putting more resources into water quality work in order to meet permit requirements and such. Also, water quality goals that all of us share. So how do we look to the state hoping for some assistance and help? One way to look at it from our perspective is we look to the state to have a consideration of a rebalancing of the state's approach. The state currently focuses almost entirely on water quality issues. This takes the form of permit requirements, like the MS4 permitting program, but also when we look at grant funding for projects and research, most of that funding is directed toward water quality. What we would like to see is more recognition and appreciation and assistance from the state in dealing with the quantity issues as well. In general, we still have a lot to learn in addressing stormwater more effectively and more cost efficiently, and the state has provided support in terms of urban stormwater research. That's been greatly appreciated, and we would very much like to see that continue. Our municipal stormwater professionals are a hard-nosed group of engineers and public works folks. Not surprisingly, we have a number of very specific, actionable, and we have reason to believe productive ideas that we would dearly love to discuss further with the state, but we're not going to be able to do it this morning. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Let's have all of our testifiers come up because there are questions. I knew there would be. If you would all come up and so we can make sure everybody's close to a microphone.
Is mics live?
There are enough chairs. I have certainly learned a lot, and I just want to tell you again how much I appreciate your coming. Representative Long has the first questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for pulling together this really informative hearing. The data is pretty staggering in terms of the amount of water that we're getting into the state. And Dr. Seeley, I think you did a compelling job of showing how our system is getting more and more out of balance with where it's been. One of the statistics that stood out to me in the past as we think about flooding events and 500-year floods or 1,000-year flood timelines, and I seem to recall that in the last two decades we've had 4,000-year flood events, I believe, and I'm wondering if I have that statistic right and if you have any updates on the 500-year flood events for the last couple of decades as well.
Dr. Seeley.
I can't substantiate if that's perfectly accurate. I do know that studies by the American Association of State Climatologists recently show that Minnesota, in terms of extreme precipitation events, has seen a dramatically increased frequency of such events since 2002. There was a study published not that many years ago that showed that in the first 140 years of state monitoring of precipitation, we had seven so-called mega rainfall events where we had 1,000 square miles of the Minnesota landscape encompassed by 6 inches or more of precipitation in a 24-hour period with a maximum core value of 8 inches or greater. Then since 2002, we've had seven additional. So in our climate history, we had seven in the first 140 years of monitoring or so, and then we've had seven more since 2002. There's been a debate within the American Meteorological Society as well as the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that the pace of change, particularly with the precipitation attribute, has quickened so intensely in our lifetime that a recalculation of the hydrologic manuals that give us the 10-year rain, the 500-year rain, the 1,000-year rain, need to be done more frequently because we're not keeping up with the pace. Anytime we do this for engineering design, we freeze frame the data, and we use that as a mandate for looking at design criteria for everything using numbers that were freeze-framed for a certain specified period. So now there's a lot of debate in those two organizations I just mentioned about what frequency should we be updating all of these NOAA Atlas manuals and looking at the frequencies. And I can tell you that the last time we did so, which was a number of years ago, the numbers changed dramatically on what was the 500-year flood or what was the 100-year flood. And that debate's going to continue. That's very disconcerting if you're a scientist, that your base data are changing so fast that you lose your confidence in having an ability to design around it.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This hearing also comes at a timely point for my district. I had a meeting with a few dozen constituents a couple of weeks ago. The Minnehaha Creek flows through my district, and all of the constituents were telling me that they were seeing basement flooding that they hadn't experienced in the entire times they'd lived in their homes, and sometimes they'd lived there for 40 or 50 years. This is, you know, impacting folks directly in my community, and it's causing challenges, I think, for our watershed planning organizations as well. And I'm curious for any of you all, what advice would you have for watershed districts on how you should be thinking about the climate future that they're all going to be facing and what types of mitigation they may need to pursue to address those issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue in many areas, riparian areas in particular, and not having a warning system is a particular problem for people. Also having appropriate design standards for new construction, but I mean your house is a sunk cost, right? You're there, and if the water level comes up to meet you, what are you going to do? I think we're going to see an expansion of the need for basement drainage, for foundation repair. These are all things that ultimately are going to be affecting property values and the desirability of these properties. And I know some areas in the Rochester area that properties simply aren't saleable anymore. I've seen issues where people have had to raise their basement floors 8 inches. And then 8 inches isn't enough after a year like last year. So very real problems that we have the ability to map where the risks are. We would have the ability to warn people of these things coming, but we don't have those systems in place now. So those are critical needs.
Ms. Schultz, can you? Okay. Yeah, we'll have both.
If I could, I would also like to remind folks, we have natural systems as well, and this should be an opportunity to rethink how we protect and preserve and maintain our natural drainage systems and our wetlands, and think a little bit harder before deciding that we can build everywhere.
So municipalities and watershed districts work essentially at the same sort of scale, the local level. So a robust discussion between local governmental units and the state that involves municipalities should also include the watershed districts and would be very productive, I believe. Shallow groundwater represents some unique challenges. We're set up to work with surface waters very effectively, and you can go out and test them and monitor the levels pretty easily. Shallow groundwater, as Jeff mentioned, groundwater represents a whole different set of challenges and can be more difficult, but obviously is going to be present some significant challenges and is worth the effort.
I think, Madam Chair, one last.
Madam Chair, if I could add, oftentimes this is one of the things that's an uninsured risk. So flood insurance, even for areas that aren't within those floodplains, is often not even available to people in those. I've seen often cases where homeowners don't even have availability of flood insurance because they're not in one of the designated flood zones, but rising soil levels can be a real hazard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question. We're in a bonding year, and the lead request from the city I represent, Minneapolis, is to replace their stormwater main in downtown. The governor got to go down in the stormwater main. I think they picked a time when there wasn't going to be predicted a big rain event and it seemed to work out okay. Curious if for Mr. Naprash, if do we have a sense for what the scale of need for stormwater replacement is in our state? Has anybody tried to estimate, you know, how much infrastructure we need to replace to be able to deal with the water that we have coming?
I appreciate the question. I wish I had a good answer for you. We do a good job of quantifying the investment and need on the drinking water side and the wastewater side. Those are much more mature sectors. Stormwater is still relatively new, and getting a good handle on cost and need is still a significant challenge on the stormwater side. With that said, I feel confident that the League of Minnesota Cities would have a number for you. And Craig has probably offered that. I'll leave it there.
I'll follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would observe that my district is downstream from Representative Long's district, and one of the things that I see as a problem is that our watershed district does not have the modeling capability to integrate surface water modeling and groundwater modeling. So this is supposed to be one of the most sophisticated wastewater system or groups in the state, watersheds in the state. So that seems to be a huge deficit then statewide if this is the most sophisticated. So with that, the next question is from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I also want to echo the appreciation that the Chair had mentioned to all of you for coming. Really amazing presentations. A number of years ago, I was at a meeting where there were legislators from several Midwestern states examining the impact of climate change on the Great Lakes. And one of the things I recall from that is that even a small temperature increase in the water on Lake Superior had some pretty major consequences environmentally and ecologically. And I'm wondering if any of you have looked at that issue of the water temperature and maybe even the amount of water in Lake Superior and how that's affecting the lake. We rely on it for fishing and recreation and all kinds of things. And so impacts of climate change on Lake Superior. I thought you might be the aquatic ecologist.
I won't claim ecologist. To be an expert. What I can offer is that for the entire 20 plus years that I've worked for the band, I've been actively engaged with the Lake Superior Partnership. It's a binational work group, state, federal, provincial, tribal agency representatives, and that is a major priority. In fact, Lake Superior, of all the Great Lakes, has really focused on the climate change impacts as a science priority and has designed a lot of the focus on research to understand what, as you point out, really, really marginal changes in temperature can do to the aquatic food webs, to the biophysical geochemical processes that happen. And in fact, there's even a new push to do a more holistic hydrologic budget that includes looking at groundwater contributions in the basin. So I can't say that anybody's got all the answers, but it's a high priority for research.
Just very quickly, Madam Chair, and again, this was a few years ago, is that your understanding that the temperature continues to rise even slightly on the Great Lakes in general and Lake Superior in particular? Is that trend continuing?
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three or four questions here. Most of them are for Ms. Novak. I suspect that you do some work with gray water, and it'd be nice for us to find out more about that because I think you're going to see more and more and more of the gray water being used in housing. But I fortunately will not be here for that particular fight. Very happy about that one. You spoke a lot about the aeration of the wastewater, and you spoke to the fact that it's about 2% of the national energy use. Are there other methods that are you are working on and actually see within the horizon of being done within the next 5 or 10 or 15 years that would aerate that? I mean, I've been in that tank. I was the one who told the engineer, why are you using steel? Why don't you use stainless steel? It'll last about 20 years longer. And he goes, oh, yeah. I love that. So I've got a couple others, but that's the big one for me right now. Is there something on the horizon that takes away that 2% energy use or $2 billion bill?
Sure. Thanks for the question. I probably should have explained this a little bit better. Bacteria can also degrade those organics in a way where they don't use oxygen. So instead of breathing oxygen, they can eat those organics but breathe carbon dioxide instead. And in that process, they generate methane gas. And methane, as you know, is natural gas. It's an excellent fuel source. The one issue with methane is it's also a very strong greenhouse gas. And so there's been a lot of work done, and in fact, this is some of the work that that St. Cloud has done in order to offset a lot of their energy use, is they're taking those waste solids and turning them into methane gas, using that methane as an energy source. We can also take the wastewater itself and treat it directly in an anaerobic process to generate methane gas. The issue there is that we just really need to be careful, especially if you think of the size of some of these plants, to capture that methane completely so it's not leaking out and making the problem worse. Some other things that can be done, and this is where we've been really focusing, is if you look at the Metro plant, which receives a huge flow of wastewater, about 170 million gallons per day of wastewater comes into that plant. About 85% of the load, so that's the organic carbon load that comes to that plant, comes from about 15 industries. And so if you can go upstream and hit those industries, you can decrease that load, and that load is directly proportional to the amount of oxygen that needs to be supplied. And so if you can take those industrial loads off the table, upstream where they're small, they're strong, they're much easier to deal with, and then let that municipal wastewater come down, you decrease that oxygen that you need to add dramatically. And that's the kind of stuff that we're working on, granted at a very small scale with the Fulton Brewery, but that's sort of the idea. And I know there are other programs I know of more in the metro area where they're looking at specific industries and trying to work with those industries, the municipality, in order to get those wastewaters treated before they get to the main plant. Does that answer your question?
Of course not.
Okay.
I have a couple of others here.
Okay, we have lots of questions, so I'll keep them very short now.
Do you have a take two plants? One is Pig's Eye, one, pick another one, St. Cloud side. To actually make that switch over to a more friendly kind of system. I don't know the cost of Pig's Eye, but I know it was hundreds of millions of dollars. Is that the same that it would take to switch that particular plant over, hundreds of millions? Because St. Paul and Minneapolis typically only get less than $50 million from the PFA.
Yeah. I don't know the number specifically. Maybe some of the PCA folks in the audience do, but I know that it would be an enormous cost. I know with St. Cloud, if you count the community solar that they're purchasing to help run that plant, they're about 98% self-supplied, which is, I think, a stunning number. And so it's possible. That plant is much smaller. It's about 10% of the size in terms of load, as the metro plant. And that, as you saw in my slides, has been a years-long process to get there. So I think it's possible. It's going to take a lot of money. And as you get larger in plant size, the amount of money that needs to be invested in order to generate the energy to run that plant is much larger. That's my wishy-washy answer.
That's something we should look at before we get too deep into it. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Mr. Broberg, we have a potential for flooding, particularly in the southern third of the state, this coming year, and I'm wondering if we have the capability within the state to test everybody's wells that might get flooded. So is the capability, and then the question of what we're testing for. You, when you had your slide up there, you were talking about bacteria back in 2007, yet we know that the problem is probably for children. Pesticides and other contaminants are much more important, or I won't say much more important, are equally important as bacteria. So talk to us a little bit about the capability.
Madam Chair, we're not even close. The records are that less than half of people test their wells within 10 years, and it mostly happens during a property sale. The response to floods for most people with private wells is a private responsibility. And the scale of this is quite astounding. I was talking to some people. Hurricane Harvey in Houston flooded 70,000 wells that needed to be tested. There was not the capacity in the United States to test those wells for bacteria. And so the best they could really do is advise people on how to disinfect for bacteria. But you're right, there's many other contaminants. And it's a particularly tough issue with what I would call non-compliant wells, those wells that were drilled before 1972. They don't have the well code. We should be extremely grateful for our well code because it does protect people if they maintain their wells, in most instances with a sealed cap and cased and grouted wells. But that's not the case certainly in Stockton or in many areas like Rushford where they found 300 non-compliant. So we really don't have that capacity, and we don't have even the emergency response capacity to do that. It's something that the health department will put out releases. You should test your well, but we don't even have the laboratory capacity to do it at the scale that would occur in many communities. So it's a critical need. I think it's something that the Clean Water Council has been talking about and future budgets. I'm hoping to see some efforts. Again, I think we need to focus on the public health aspects of this. It's not just the flooding. It is a critical measure of public health, and we need to take that health view.
Thank you for that. I see we're running short on time. Let me ask the last question then. From Schultz, on your slide that talked about mercury concerns, you said that the statewide TMDL for mercury does not include the St. Louis River. That seems like a major gap.
The statewide mercury TMDL is intended to reduce statewide mercury emissions 90% over, I think, 1990 baseline. Each sector that emits mercury has sector reduction goals. And even if all of the sectors that emit mercury to the environment meet those sector reduction goals for the statewide TMDL by 2025, there are hundreds of water bodies around the state where the mercury in the water column or the mercury in the fish, which is what's important for human health, will still exceed water quality limits and human health limits. The St. Louis River watershed and the tributaries and the lakes within it, those are some of the waters that I'm talking about, where the statewide TMDL alone is not sufficient. And there's a recognition that we need to be working on another additional TMDL specific to those watersheds and water bodies that will reduce not only the mercury emissions, but how mercury works its way through the food web. There are other places that we need to be addressing that. And we were underway some years ago working with the MPCA, EPA Region 5, the Wisconsin DNR to work on a on a toxics TMDL for the St. Louis River watershed. We were a couple of years into that, and the state of Minnesota pulled out. And at this point, we have not reinvigorated a TMDL process for the St. Louis River.
You will talk about no longer pulling out. I mean, that's that. I appreciate your alerting us to that. Thank you. Representative Long, we have minutes from April 4th, February 6th, and February 7th. Would you move those minutes?
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any objection? The minutes are approved. Members, thank you so much. I see no more questions, and I really appreciate folks taking their time to help us out. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Meeting's adjourned.